From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's airing of Public Health Radio, we'll be presenting a revised version of a show from the Public Health Radio archive. On last month's show, and now today, we're presenting most of the content of both parts of a two-part series first broadcast 2 years ago. These two shows provide an in-depth look at the Medicare Reform Act, passed in November of 2003. The implementation of the new Medicare program on January 1st this year brought a great deal of confusion and even chaos. But many people still don't fully understand the relationship between the turmoil that occurred with the program's initiation and how the program will function over the coming years, or the implications of Medicare's new structure on the future of the Medicare program and its more than 40 million beneficiaries. On last month's airing of Public Health Radio, we looked at the role of private insurance plans in the new Medicare. Today, Leslie Norwalk, the Deputy Administrator of the Medicare program, is joining us to discuss the prescription drug benefit the new bill offers. On the show, Norwalk highlights the key role pharmacy benefit management companies assume in the new Medicare. Since these companies receive little media attention, I've asked Robert Garris to join us on the second part of the show. Garris is an expert on this industry sector, and he'll give us an overview of what these companies' management techniques have on the cost of prescription drugs. Then, later in the show, I'll be providing a new commentary on the Medicare reform law that includes a reflection on what we've learned from the dysfunction of the last 6 months, and a vision of an alternative model for the future of Medicare. So stay with us for a look at the brave new world of Medicare 2006. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Last month, on the first segment of our two-part look at the Medicare reform bill, we reviewed the array of scandals that have stirred around the legislation and also discussed the less publicized part of the legislation, the privatization of Medicare. That show is accessible at our website, publichealthradio.org. We'll return to the implications of Medicare's privatization toward the end of today's show. But for most of today's broadcast, we'll be looking at the drug benefit, which is, of course, the main feature of the bill that is of immediate interest to Medicare enrollees. One of my own patients, Al LaPrade, agreed to appear on today's show. Mr. LaPrade is a retired trucker who lives in Williamstown, Vermont. Al LaPrade, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Mr. LaPrade, I know that you take 12 medications, but I've never before asked you how much these 12 medications cost you each month. So what's your monthly expense for your prescription drugs?
Well, right here in the state of Vermont, for one set of medications, $592.54.
So that would seem to be a lot of money. That would be $7,200 a year, something like that.
Yes. It's very expensive. See, like Celebrex, I have to pay $165.10 for 56 of them. And Acifex is $134.35.
For how many?
For 28.8. And
for 1 month supply?
Yeah, 28 days.
Yeah.
And then Lipitor is $105.02 for 28 days.
So you couldn't afford the $7,000 a year, and you had to come up with other ideas.
Yeah.
So what did you discover?
So I discovered, I found out somebody from Canada, I'd buy medication through them. And like what I just ordered yesterday was the Acifex, which for a 4-month supply is $295.
So that would be, sounded like about half the price?
Just about half.
What about some other ones?
Well, the Celebrex was less than half. That was around, I think it was $283.
So that'd be about 30 or 40% less.
Yep.
And what did the total come to? Did you get all of them there or just some of them?
No, I just got part of them from through them right now.
Mm-hmm. Did you figure out the total difference in price?
The total difference is about 42%.
42% less when you ordered from Canada.
Yep.
So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's, you know, the United States has got to do something. I mean, Canada buys the medication from us. So why can't we sell it as cheap as they do? That's my idea. Like, I don't understand why we got to pay such high prices here in the United States.
Well, I'm going to be interviewing Leslie Norwalk, the deputy administrator of the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and I'll ask her that question.
Yeah.
Anything else you want me to ask her?
Well, I'd like to see Medicare pay for some of these prescriptions.
Well, now that the Medicare Reform Act has gone into effect, Medicare is able to pay a portion of Mr. LaPrade's prescriptions, if he's willing to stop purchasing them from Canada. But of course, it's been a complicated process. For the first 2 years of the program, seniors received a drug discount card. Sounded simple, but the cards were administered by a large number of private insurance companies, so the magnitude of the benefit varied depending on the price the individual company was able to negotiate at a given time. Then, in January of this year, the discount cards expired, and seniors can now choose among an array of other insurance plans if they still want a drug benefit. Some of these companies offer only prescription drugs. Others are comprehensive HMOs. Total monthly premiums for those who sign up for the drug plan are just over $100 per month. Because the Reform Act is paying private insurance plans so much to contract with Medicare, most comprehensive plans are able to charge seniors less than the $100 per month that the public Medicare program is charging, and Medicare enrollees thus have an incentive to leave traditional Medicare. Adding to the stress of this decision, Medicare enrollees who fail to sign up by May 15th of this year will pay an additional $1 per month for each month they delay their decision. This would mean that if a senior chose to enroll in the drug program at age 70 rather than 65, their premium for the remainder of their life would be $162 per month rather than $102. The drug benefit itself is equally complicated. In addition to paying the monthly premium, enrollees pay 100% of the first $250, then 25% of drug cost until they hit $2,250 of total pharmacy costs. Then, despite continuing to pay their monthly premium, enrollees receive no coverage at all until they reach $5,100 in costs, after which they pay only 5% of the cost of their medicines. What's not clear is what any given prescription will cost, since that will depend how well the insurer they've signed up with does in negotiating with the drug companies. As was the case with Mr. LaPrade, most of my patients have been skeptical and confused by the program, and many are continuing to order their medications from Canada. It's unquestionably the case that Medicare would be able to negotiate much lower drug prices if representatives of the Medicare program itself negotiated directly with the pharmaceutical companies. Presumably, drug prices might then be on a par with the prices citizens of most other developed countries pay. So I asked Leslie Norwalk, the Deputy Chief Administrator of the Medicare program, why the Medicare Reform Bill was preventing Medicare from undertaking direct negotiation with the drug companies.
A lot of people talk about this new law prohibiting negotiation. That's not actually what it does. The new law prohibits the department from interfering in the negotiations that our agents do on behalf of Medicare beneficiaries. And let me explain how that works. The health plans, the Medicare Advantage plans, and the prescription drug plans that individuals could voluntarily join in order to get this drug benefit in 2006, they will in fact be negotiating payments on behalf for better drug prices on behalf of beneficiaries. And interestingly, these are the same types of companies, these are the same pharmaceutical benefit manufacturers who currently negotiate drug prices for me as a member of the Federal Employees Health Benefit Program, as well as for the Secretary and members of Congress and anyone else in the executive, legislative, or judicial branch who gets their health benefits through the federal program. So these are the exact same companies who are negotiating on behalf of the Medicare beneficiaries come 2006. And the reason that's important to know is because while Medicare has 41 million beneficiaries, or 41 million covered lives, if you will, these companies, these pharmaceutical benefit manufacturers, have more, 51 million, 61 million, 71 million. The top three have considerably more beneficiaries than Medicare has, and they will bring that bargaining power to bear for Medicare beneficiaries. So those numbers, in fact, their numbers will get larger, and they may actually do better than Medicare does because of the competition process.
At this point, the drug costs in the U.S., they have not been able to drive them down.
Well, I think that depends on how you look at it.
If you've got hundreds of plans around the country, I don't know how you can be confident that you're going to get the kind of 40% average cost reduction that they're seeing in Europe and in Canada and Australia.
The real way to drive down prices, and something else that this law changes, is to bring generic drugs to market faster. In fact, generic drugs, which is about half of the U.S. market, the generics are pretty much on par with the Canadian drug prices, and depending on the exchange rate, because the exchange rate plays a very big role, as it does in any trade, as to the actual prices of things. And as the U.S. dollar continues to slide, those margins will continue to diminish. But I think there's a very small percentage difference between U.S. generic drug prices and Canadian prices. And in fact, U.S. generic prices are cheaper than any other drug prices around the world.
Speaking as a physician, I can tell you that I prescribe generic medications whenever I can, but there are limitations to that. And we really end up needing both. And the other point I'd make is that if you look at patients' pharmacy bills, it's usually the brand name drugs that are adding up to most of the total. So I think the power of some agent, whether it's the government or one of these other agents that you're speaking of, the importance of driving down the cost of brand name drugs, I think, is really great. I can say that on behalf of my patients, including the fellow I interviewed for this show.
I mean, obviously, we feel the same, or we wouldn't be trying to get out a discount card, trying to have beneficiaries, particularly Medicare beneficiaries who pay more than everybody else, to try and extract some discounts on their behalf. Trust me, it's been a lot of work over the past number of months to get this up in a short period of time. So that and our push to get generics to market faster, it's pretty clear that we just see a different approach to what the best way to reduce drug prices, and that's the American way of competition, which is how we drive the prices down on all sorts of goods, whether it be food products or cars or whatever else it is that we do in this country, also often a vital need to individuals.
Except that it's hard for me to understand how competition is on your side here, because there's only a very limited number of drug manufacturers. Essentially, they form a cartel. So if you want to have lots of agents across the country, or these plans, HMO plans across the country, if there's several hundred of them, I suppose there would be if you want each metro area to have four or five plans. It's hard to understand how having numerous plans standing up to each of them not having that many beneficiaries standing up to a drug company, which is in some cases, the only one or one of one or two or three that are producing a drug in a particular class. It's hard to understand how that distorted competition negotiating with a cartel is going to help to drive costs down.
Well, I think you raise a good point. One is that those drugs that are patent protected, those single source drugs, for example, there's a reason. In fact, even the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution put in patent protection within Article 1. So long, the entire history of this country is founded on protecting innovations and of companies or individuals. And that continues in the drug industry. And I can assure you, I can imagine what the pharmaceutical manufacturers say to that, which is they need this in order to put money back into additional innovations, many of which never succeed. But your point about plans, we'll have what we hope to have in 2006 is a wide variety. Some of them may be local, but we also hope to have regional plans. We may have statewide plans. Who knows exactly what will be available because we haven't finished writing the regulations yet, much less seen who is going to come in to the markets. But we have at any number of levels, there are most of these plans contract with pharmaceutical benefit manufacturers there are, a fair number, but I mentioned, say, the top three or four with over 50 million lives that are covered. These PBMs would contract with these HMOs and other plans, PPOs, for example, and so it's often the PBM that is doing the job of driving the bargains with the pharmaceutical companies.
But they've been scandal-ridden, and most of them are owned by pharmaceutical companies, right?
Actually, that's no longer true. At least I know of Merck, while at one point owned a company called Medco. That was spun off, and they are no longer under common ownership. So I'm not sure that any of them left are actually owned by both the manufacturer. I think they've all been spun off, mainly for the concerns about conflict of interest that you raise. In terms of being scandal-ridden, I don't know of any current either indictments or prosecutions that have come to the end of the day, which is to say where people have gone to jail. I mean, that's not to say that that there haven't been issues with a particular industry, but none come to mind where there has been a guilty verdict.
Do you expect the ultimate cost of drugs to be as low as it is in Canada or Europe? We're 40% lower than what we pay here in the U.S.?
I think it depends on when you say drugs, it's an awfully broad category. I think, as you pointed out before, whether it's brand name or whether it's generic or how many sources there are for it or whether there's an alternative therapy, all of those things, as you would expect, play a role as to the particular price of the drug.
No, just brand name drugs in general.
It depends on how bad the dollar falls. As the other currencies become increasingly more expensive, it will become less. The other drugs will also become more expensive as any other product would in those countries.
Okay, I will not ask you the question of how far the administration expects the dollar to fall. I will not ask that question. Do you know if the administration or you personally object to the Veterans Administration's negotiating exactly the same way I'm talking about, where they've actually, on average, driven drug costs lower than what Canada pays?
You're talking about the VA supply schedule. They're two entirely different. I mean, Medicare, I'm presuming you're comparing it to Medicare as well, as opposed to the government at large, which does not buy drugs for people.
The Veterans Administration.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But the Veterans Administration compared to the Medicare program.
Well, I'm saying the Veterans Administration negotiates drugs, and
correct,
the ultimate price they pay,
right,
is actually better than pharmacies in Canada have to offer. And
if
that could be done for Medicare, if the government could do that for Medicare beneficiaries, maybe we could even beat Canada.
The VA program is an end user, which is to say the VA actually buys the drugs. It's not like they negotiate on behalf of veterans. They buy the drugs themselves and distribute the drugs themselves, as opposed to being an insurance program, which is what Medicare is. And they're entirely different, not only in that sort of structure, but as well as the structure of just the sheer number of beneficiaries. So the VA is the differences are vast. I think the VA is less than, is maybe around 1%, where the Medicare population is between 40 and 50% of all drug spending. So it would dramatically change how it is that drugs are delivered to this country. There's no doubt. And I'm not, I don't know whether or not, if I'm a pharmaceutical manufacturer, you might want to ask them, whether or not they'd be willing to even offer drugs to Medicare if they extracted discounts to the impact that the VA might have on a 40 to 50% across the board. I don't know.
But I suspect that many senior citizens would want to find out for themselves just how much the drug companies might be willing to lower their prices if the Medicare administrators did the negotiating directly, as they do at the VA. But that's expressly prohibited in the Medicare reform legislation, so we won't get to find out. While journalists have frequently pointed out that the pharmaceutical manufacturers and the private insurance companies got exactly what they wanted from the Medicare reform bill, virtually no attention has gone to the PBMs, the pharmaceutical benefit management companies. As we've just heard, Leslie Norwalk, the deputy director of the Medicare program, expects that these companies will be taking on the lead role of negotiating with the drug companies on behalf of the private insurance plans with which Medicare enrollees will be signing up to be able to access the new Medicare drug benefit. And how they do in this negotiation will matter a great deal. The price of prescription drugs will remain a pivotal issue to enrollees, since the new drug benefit will only be paying for $1,500 out of the first $5,000 of drug costs each year. Senior citizens will have to pay the other 70% out of their own money. After a short break, we'll continue Public Health Radio's two-part series on the Medicare Reform Act passed last November by taking an in-depth look at these PBM intermediaries who will be taking on such a key role in the brave new world of Medicare. Bob Garris, an expert on this industry sector, will be joining us. We'll learn how these companies do business, where their profit comes from, how generic drug prices are likely to be impacted, and we'll be revisiting the extent to which this industry sector has been the object of public investigation and litigation. So stay tuned. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On the last two airings of Public Health Radio, we've been exploring the Medicare Reform Act. Critics of the legislation have noted that taxpayers would be spending far more than necessary on the Medicare program as a consequence of the legislation, because the private health insurance industry and the drug companies got so much of what they were lobbying for into the final bill. The legislation sets aside $46 billion for payments to private health insurance companies to lure them into the Medicare program. And the pharmaceutical industry got both key planks it most valued into the legislation. Medicare would not be paying for medicines re-imported from Canada and other foreign countries, and the Medicare program would not be negotiating directly with the drug companies. But far less attention has been paid to a third health industry sector, which was also well served by the legislation. Earlier on today's show, Leslie Norwalk, the chief administrator of the Medicare program, indicated in clear terms that she fully expects the pharmacy benefit management companies to serve as the primary industry group that will be negotiating with the drug companies. And she stated clearly that she expects them to achieve price reductions similar to what beneficiaries would have gotten had Medicare itself negotiated directly with drug companies. Joining us to explore the PBM industry is Robert Garris. Dr. Garris is a pharmacist and an assistant professor in the College of Pharmacy at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. Studying the pharmaceutical benefit management industry is one of his leading research interests, and as such, he is only one of a handful of researchers who have carefully studied this industry sector. I asked Dr. Garris to explain to our listeners what PBMs actually do.
The PBM, or pharmacy benefit manager, can be considered a broker between the person that pays for the prescription coverage, whether it be Medicare, whether it be our employers, so the payer of care, and the pharmacies that fill our prescriptions. These payers of care who wish to provide a prescription benefit need an entity with vast computer resources that can communicate with essentially all the pharmacies in the United States. Via these computer connections, the PBM can simultaneously bill the payer or our employer and pay our pharmacy for the prescriptions we get.
Now, the major PBMs are profit-seeking corporations traded on the stock exchanges.
Absolutely.
So obviously they have to generate a profit. And I was wondering if you could lay out how they actually do that. Where exactly is their profit coming from?
Okay. Let's start off with the highly visible, upfront, well-understood payment. That is the administrative fee that's charged by the PBM. That's a fee that compensates the PBM for performing a transaction. It is also a fee that's very well specified. It's very explicit in the contracts. These fees have been going down over the years, by the way, down from 75 cents per prescription, down to 50, 25, and so on down. In fact, we're seeing PBMs now charging administrative fees in the 10 to 15 cents per prescription. So it seems to me like the highly visible fee that every payer of the benefit is highly aware of keeps going down. That's almost like a loss leader in the grocery store. And I think there are three cash flows to the PBM that really ultimately drive up the price to any payer of care, Medicare, for instance.
And these other three are hidden, you're saying?
They're hidden.
And what are these three?
Let's look at spread pricing for just a minute. So I believe we said that the PBM was a broker between the payer of the prescription benefit and the pharmacies that fill up prescriptions. So the PBM, in performing its broker functional, will form a set of contracts with both entities, the payer and the pharmacies. What happens is the terms of these two contracts can be different. So it's via this differential contracting that the PBM may create a positive cash flow to itself.
In other words, they're buying the drug for one price and selling it at a high...
No, PBMs don't buy the drugs. They don't dispense the drugs, generally. They just make paper arrangements. The pharmacies buy and dispense the drugs. The PBMs simply get the cash, simply pass through all the charges to the payer of care. The payer of care pays the PBM, who in turn pays the pharmacy some of that money. So let's say we go to the pharmacy and get a prescription for pain pills. We pay our $10 copayment or whatever and are on our way. Now, behind the scenes in the electronic transactions, the payer of care might be charged $100, while the pharmacy for that same prescription is paid $40. Therefore, a $60 cash flow or $60 spread accrues to the PBM.
And is that percentage of 60% spread, that's got to be high?
That's one of the dramatic examples that...
So that actually happened. That's from...
It's a real example. I can tell you that based on our research that's ongoing, that we're finding it's common practice for the PBM to take $5 to $10 in spread per prescription. So given the fact that each household typically gets about 16 prescriptions, it's pretty easy to see how much spread is fueling the cost of prescription drugs.
Now, you mentioned that there were three areas that are more hidden, three ways that
exactly.
are somewhat hidden that the PBM can makes its profits. So why don't you proceed on? And the first was, of course, the spread that you've just been discussing. So what would the second one be?
The second one is PB-owned mail-order pharmacy. Now, it's almost become institutionalized in corporate America and in the government as well, that mail-order pharmacy is a better value than community retail pharmacy. And I can tell you that what we're finding whenever we compare retail to mail order on the exact prescriptions, this is making us seriously doubt whether PBM-affiliated mail order is truly a good value. But if we look at this, since this has been institutionalized, corporate America, the payers of health care, typically incentivize the members that they cover to use mail order because they're convinced it's cheaper. So they will make copayments lower to use mail order. They will restrict the amount of medication that the members can get in a non-mail order facility. That is, you can only get 30 days in retail, but 90 days or more in mail order.
So that then the consumer's copays would add up and end up being much higher that way, if they had to go in each month.
Right. Yeah, the consumers are being rewarded to go through mail order when mail order may be about equal to community retail pharmacy or maybe even a little higher.
You're talking about mail order in general or mail order when it's organized by these PBMs companies?
That's a good point. I meant to say, and I appreciate you bringing this up, when I say mail order, I'm referring to PBM-owned or PBM-affiliated mail order.
And this is a big part of their business, evidently.
It's a huge part of their business. And, you know, like Andrew Carnegie, as he was making his first few million dollars, he was an agent for the railroad, and he was simply the buyer. He was a buyer for the railroad, so he was also a steel producer, so he was the buyer and the seller of the steel. So it's kind of a self-dealing arrangement. So given what we've seen, that is, let me give you an example. Atenolol, a blood pressure medication, costs the sponsor about $10 through a retail facility and over $40 in mail order for the same strength, same quantity. Generic form of Prozac, we just noticed probably last week, cost the sponsor less than $60 in retail and over $120 from the mail order pharmacy. So what we do, we take, let's say...
So these insurance companies or payers are actually losing money when the consumers, the people who have the insurance, are mailing away for their drug.
The payer of care?
Yeah, the payer
is
actually losing money.
They're having to pay more. Sure. It's costing them more. And it's been so institutionalized that mail order is the better value that people just haven't been questioning this.
And then you mentioned earlier that the PBM may be making some of its money from rebates.
The drug manufacturers are willing to pay the PBM a rebate to get their drug product on the PBM formulary. So let's say, let's have some fun with this. Let's take the three products for erectile dysfunction. Let's take Cialis, Viagra, and Levitra. All right, we have three competing drugs in a very high-profile category. The makers of each drug will offer a rebate to the PBM to favor their drug. And in so doing, the drug manufacturer will pay the PBM a certain amount for each unit of drug that the PBM dispenses, and in turn, the PBM will pay to the plan sponsor, to the insurer, a certain amount of that rebate back, but the PBM will keep a chunk of the rebate. So, in essence, the rebate is paid by the drug manufacturer to get favorable position on the PBM's formulary. The drug manufacturer exchanges dollars for market share of their drug being dispensed. And that's, I would say, the third way that PBMs make a big share of their profits.
Now, Ms. Norwalk highlighted the efforts of the Bush administration. They're making an effort to promote the prescribing of generic drugs. These are drugs where the patent has expired, and then their other drug companies can produce the same medication and presumably drive down prices. But I was rather surprised to see that PBMs actually, in general, seem to make their largest profit margin on generics. Is that actually true?
That is true. They make a larger percent profit off a smaller base, but certainly it's a dramatic profit margin. So I guess I would say to that generic drugs are unequivocally less expensive than their brand name counterpart. However, because of differential contracting, the value of generic substitution, of generic drug use, is not as good a value as it could be. See, I think that's where some of the biggest cash flows come from, is the differential pricing on generic drugs. We found an example in which for generic Zantac, the stomach medication, the payer of care was billed $200 for a prescription. The pharmacy was paid $15. So the actual spread to the PBM was nearly $200. So it's a real problem. We find this differential contracting on generics in essentially all the large corporations that we look at.
During my interview with Ms. Norwalk, the chief administrator of Medicare, I actually was surprised to hear her say so clearly that there was definitely an expectation that the PBMs would manage the drug benefit. I just had no idea that their expectation was that clear. And I asked her about that because I'm by no means an expert on that industry, quite far from it. It's really only now I'm doing reading and preparation. But I had already heard in just reading newspapers, some scandals in the industry and even lawsuits against them, and she seemed to indicate that was not the case. Is that actually true? Because I swore I had heard of at least a court in Boston that was taking the issue up. Are you familiar with any
You heard correctly. There's a lot of litigation against PBMs. The U.S. attorney has a suit against the PBM Medco right now. The prescription access litigation.
And who does that represent?
That represents, I believe, a coalition of purchasers. A coalition of large corporations has a lawsuit against PBMs. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees have a suit against PBMs right now. The National Community Pharmacist Association has a suit. The Pharmacy Freedom Fund, which is a coalition of independent pharmacists and maybe some state pharmacist associations, have a lawsuit.
On what grounds are these lawsuits? If the PBMs are just charging what the payer is willing to pay and they're obtaining their product at the lowest possible cost, what kind of grounds do any of these plaintiffs have against them?
I think it's going to boil down to whether the PBM is shown to have a fiduciary responsibility or not.
To the payer.
Right.
Huh.
Whether or not the PBMs are found to be fiduciaries is going to be a huge issue in the structure and future structure of the PBM industry.
Now, the combination of the current economic recession, meaning less tax revenue to the states, at the same time as the health costs, you know, are always rising so much, that's really strained a lot of state government budgets across the country. And, of course, drug cost and pharmaceutical cost inflation has been the most rapidly growing health costs, both in the Medicaid programs and in general, I believe. And I know that many states have begun using these PBM companies to try to save money on their pharmaceutical costs. So what is the overall feeling on the part of the state government Medicaid administrators about PBMs?
Well, I'd have to say the short answer is the state governments have had a lot of problems with PBMs. New York is found overcharging by the PBM. The PBM had to pay New York, the state of New York, back. Vermont has found spread pricing. Arkansas found overcharging. 20-some states' attorneys general are either actively seeking you know, a suit with PBMs or at least investigating them. The bottom line is a lot of state governments have had a lot of trouble with PBMs. I wouldn't say they're happy with them.
Now, you mentioned that Vermont, the state of Vermont found that there was spread pricing.
Yes.
But what did the state of Vermont expect? I mean, did they expect that the only source of revenue that these companies had was from just the very small administrative fee? I don't understand what Vermont might have expected.
Every payer of care that I talk to, I hardly talk to a payer of care, be it corporate, you know, public or private, that really understand where the cash flows are here. So to say that any given payer of care doesn't understand about spread pricing, doing this every day, that doesn't surprise me at all. Because the general awareness of this in the benefit industry is not widely known.
Earlier on today's show, Leslie Norwalk, the chief administrator of the Medicare program, stated that the big three PBM companies each have 50 to 70 million covered lives. So they're going to be in a strong position to do the negotiating and save Medicare and its beneficiaries money. Given the many hidden ways that the PBMs are extracting profits from their broker position, which you've pointed out, what are your thoughts on Ms. Norwalk's belief that these PBMs will serve as the ideal broker to administer the Medicare drug benefit?
As far as your question about how many covered patients each PBM has, that's a little bit harder to determine. I've found that these figures on the census for each PBM are pretty highly inflated. So I would call into question that 51 million. I don't know where she got that. But what I would say with relative certainty is that the 40 million Medicare recipients, which are heavy drug users, I think the government would be plenty strong in negotiating based on those people. That is, I don't see any clear advantage to the PBM doing the negotiating in this case.
Well, Robert Garris, I'd really like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Coming up next, I'll provide a commentary and final thought on our exploration of the Medicare reform bill. So stay with us. Thank you.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The last two airings of Public Health Radio have attempted to provide an introduction to the new Medicare plan voted into law back in November of 2003. Even though the bill was passed over 2 years ago, it's received a great deal of attention recently because the main part of the program was just implemented in the last few months. So far, almost all the press coverage the bill has received has been unfavorable. Medicare enrollees were supposed to start selecting a plan last November. This process turned out to be even more chaotic than we here at Public Health Radio and many other critics had predicted. Information provided by Medicare's 800 number was as often as not incorrect or misleading, and almost every web-savvy patient of mine who attempted to use the Medicare website found it to be unhelpful and incomplete. Then on January 1st, the actual date of implementation, more chaos ensued. This involved about 4 million Medicare enrollees, known as dual eligibles. These individuals qualify not only for Medicare, but also for Medicaid. This is not only the sickest 15% of the Medicare population, but probably the sickest category of any insured group in the country. It turned out that the Medicare administrators failed to properly transmit the names and IDs of these individuals to the various insurance companies to which these dual eligibles were assigned. Absent from the insurance company's databases, the companies were not willing to pay for the medications. Well, this couldn't have happened to a worse group of patients. These individuals were completely unable to pay, and many of these individuals are so sick, they depend on a dozen or more medications. So across the country, nearly all the state Medicaid programs were forced to step back in on an emergency basis, and it ended up taking over 2 months for this dysfunction to be resolved. To this day, it's still not clear if the insurance companies involved will refund the money they received from Medicare, since over 2 months went by before many of them actually had to pay a cent for the medications they were supposed to be funding. Thus, the initial implementation of the program was so riddled in dysfunction that an astonishing thing happened on the 31st of January. Even though he had presided over the creation of the largest social program we've seen in 40 years, President Bush didn't even mention the new Medicare program in his State of the Union message. That was breathtaking. We've seen incompetence in implementation several other times during the years of the Bush administration, most notoriously in Iraq and in New Orleans. Though it certainly deserved the attention it received, the incompetence we've seen over the last few months in getting the new Medicare program going is only a small, minor part of the problem with the structure that President Bush and the congressional Republicans chose in reforming Medicare and adding a prescription drug benefit. And now that many of the snafus of initiating the program have finally been worked out, the media may fail to take note of the far more important long-term problems that are built into the new Medicare. The program is extremely dysfunctional and enormously wasteful of taxpayer money. The waste occurs because the bill diverts untold billions of dollars away from medical care and away from the cost of drugs, and instead directs those dollars into the coffers of the wealthy triumvirate of industry sectors that lobbied so hard to get the bill passed. The insurance companies, the pharmaceutical industry, and the least publicized group, the PBMs, which we looked at in depth earlier on today's show. Why can't private insurance plans provide insurance coverage as inexpensively as Medicare? That's because private plans have many more costs than Medicare. Each plan has to go out and sign up doctors in every conceivable specialty,
and negotiate deals with hospitals, physical therapists, and all the other specialty areas. Plans typically open enrollment each year and usually turn over a quarter to a third of their enrollees. All of this registration activity and promotion requires money. Private plans spend far more than Medicare does on what they call claims management. Doctors simply think of this as annoying micromanagement. And virtually all of the 1,500 health insurance companies pay their top managers far more than what Medicare pays. And the many companies that are investor-owned also have to pay dividends to investors. Most of the companies, whether for-profit or not, devote a good deal of money to lobbying and donating to political campaigns. And a final cost which public sector programs don't face is the cost of advertising and marketing. They produce and pay for ads to run on TV and pay to enter their corporate logo in as many newspapers as they can afford. These costs mount up, and it isn't surprising that private insurance plans end up diverting so much of their revenue to administrative costs. Private insurance companies represents an extremely inefficient way to pay for health care. But as we've seen today, the outlays of money in the Medicare Reform Bill not only go to private insurance companies, but also to the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit management companies, who will be the intermediaries managing the prescription drug benefit. They will also be draining money from the program in the billions. As we discussed in detail earlier in today's show, they practice spread pricing, they overcharge for mail order prescriptions, and they receive hefty rebates from drug companies for favoring particular drugs. But most all of the benefit of their bulk purchasing goes to their own bottom line and won't result in Medicare and its enrollees saving money. But the administrative burden in the Medicare Reform Bill is not limited to the insurance companies and the PBMs. The burden on pharmacies and doctors' offices is enormous, contending with different billing procedures. Each company has their own specific list of preferred drugs, so we doctors have to check out separate lists for each patient before we can write a prescription. The bureaucratic burden that this bill imposes on the Medicare program itself has also escaped media attention. For four decades, the Medicare program has been able to keep its administrative costs below 3% of outlays. But now, having to implement and administer this complex privatization scheme, Medicare's own bureaucratic costs are likely to rise at least 50% and may even double. But the most unnecessary burden of all is on the senior citizens and their families. The Medicare Reform Bill was clearly designed with the prudent, careful consumer in mind. But there could hardly be a more vulnerable group than the Medicare population of elderly and disabled people. The sickest seniors will be the ones most impacted by their choice of plan, and they will have to contend with these companies when they get sick and use a lot of health care. Then they will clearly not be in a position to take on insurance company regulations with the frequent denials and delays that invariably involves. So in many cases, it will fall on the children of the Medicare population to take on these battles, as well as to sort through promotional materials from the various plans each year to try to figure out which is the best deal for their parents. So the administrative burden on the consumers will in many cases fall on the younger generation, and many of them are busy with demands of their jobs and of raising their own children. Finally, the promotion of private plans could very well destabilize and even destroy the entire Medicare program. One feature of the bill that has received scant attention is a demonstration project set to begin in 2010, which will involve the complete elimination of traditional Medicare and transfer the entire program to HMOs and insurance companies in several major metropolitan areas. For nearly 10 years, Americans under age 65 have seen a downward spiral in the quality of their health insurance. Many of us have been forced into bare-bones plans that involve paying out huge deductibles before any insurance kicks in. The last thing our senior citizens need is the same downward spiral that could provide them with very poor coverage. If seniors are forced to contend with a private health insurance market, none of the sickest elderly people are likely to select the bare-bones plans. So the plans the sickest senior citizens enroll in will either lose money or be forced to either drastically increase premiums or more likely simply reduce benefits. This would set off a downward spiral of health insurance, just like the one those of us under age 65 have been facing. There never was a reason why the regular Medicare program couldn't have simply offered a quality drug benefit. Had Medicare been allowed to negotiate directly with drug companies, they would doubtless have negotiated large discounts and then passed on these discounts to our senior citizens. This would have given our senior citizens a reasonable benefit with far lower cost to taxpayers. It's inappropriate to craft a health system for senior citizens that requires them to be prudent, careful consumers. No doubt many of them are capable of taking on that role, but we all know that our elderly neighbors, parents, and grandparents simply need a caring hand from a stable program with reliable benefits that will be there for them year after year. This is not what we've seen with the reformed Medicare program. I encourage our legislators to simply go back to the drawing board and do much better. These are our parents and our grandparents. We're supposed to support them and care for them, not hassle them and find ways to extract a profit from their medical care. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.